Writers' Voices. You're listening to Cheryl Fusco Johnson at KRUU 100.1 FM. I'm excited about the show we have today. We have a very special guest, a hometown girl. Her name is Jenny Rothenberg-Gritz. She's the senior editor and multimedia editor at The Atlantic. She began her association with the magazine as an intern in 2002, shortly after earning an MA in journalism from the University of California, Berkeley. An early highlight of her Atlantic career was a visit with literary critic and Yale professor Harold Bloom. In January 2006, Jenny joined the Atlantic staff full-time. She currently oversees a number of different areas, producing the online edition of the magazine and its special features, editing theatlantic.com's national, and creating original videos for the website. Before joining The Atlantic, Jenny was senior editor of Moment, a national magazine founded by Eli Wiesel, where she remains a contributing editor. Her writing has also appeared in the Chicago Tribune and in the book The Kindness of Strangers, a Lonely Planet travel writing anthology. Jenny grew up in Fairfield and is a graduate of the Marishi University of Management, where she earned her BA in literature. Welcome, Jenny.
Thanks so much for having me, Cheryl.
It's such a cool thing to have you back in town, even if briefly. So tell me a little about what your duties are at The Atlantic. What exactly do you do there? It sounded like you do so many things.
Yeah, well, I should say that it's been a really exciting time to be there because I feel like my career in online journalism has really paralleled the sort of ebb and flow of the past 10 years in a really interesting way. When I first started journalism, it was the big dot-com boom. And when I was in graduate school, everyone wanted to take all the classes in multimedia and online writing. And then right around the middle of my master's degree, it all kind of crashed down. And suddenly, nobody wanted to take those classes anymore. And so it was an interesting thing because it was all just financially driven. The internet, as everyone knows, was growing and growing. It wasn't like people were losing interest in reading stuff online. It was just that there was all this early creativity and no one really thought about money. And then suddenly people just realized, wait a second, we're not making any money doing this. And that's what happened at The Atlantic. When I was first an intern there back in, I guess it was 2002, they just massively downsized. They'd started as one of the really early pioneers in online journalism, and they had a huge staff of really young 20-something creative people just doing all kinds of cool stuff. And then the corporate side of the company said, wait a second, why are we paying all these people to do this when you're not making money? And in fact, you're kind of cannibalizing the magazine. You know, we want, that's what's making us money. So they had just downsized to just three people. And then
When you were an intern, they did.
Yeah, it was just kind of a recent crunch. And then after I left, it downsized even more to the point where they just didn't want anything except what was in the magazine and then special features that kind of, in a way, advertised what was in the magazine. So, you know, if there's an article, you could interview the author of that article and that could be an online feature. But they didn't want any original content on the web just given out for free. So I started working full-time there around, it was 2006. And just around that time, it was kind of the lowest point. At that point, it was just only one person working at the website, and I was brought on as like a second helper. And there was really not much attention at all being put on the site. Everything had been totally crunched down. And then suddenly, everyone realized you can make money on the web. You just have to do it differently. And they started really putting attention on that. And so now the Atlantic website's actually really burgeoning, really lively. Things have come full circle, and there's a young, cool staff of smart 20-somethings, just, you know, tons of us. And I mean, I shouldn't say us, I'm in my 30s, but tons of them.
Well, it looks like a really interesting publication, but I wanted to backtrack just a little bit, and if you could tell listeners, in case they might not be familiar with The Atlantic, a little about its early history, because it's a magazine that's like over 150 years old. It has great tradition of being very thoughtful and literary. So could you tell us a little bit about the background of The Atlantic?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, The Atlantic is a very cool place to work because it was founded by the Transcendentalists back in 1857. Actually, the first issue in November 1857 had a poem called Brahma by Ralph Waldo Emerson that was based on chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita. So it has very profound roots. It was mainly started as an abolitionist magazine in New England, in Boston, but it was more than that. It was also just a really deep thinking, you know, literary kind of magazine. John Muir wrote some of his earliest stuff for us, just beautiful pieces about Yosemite and nature. And
Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Yeah, Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Who were some of the other founders? Can you remember?
Well, some of the writers who kind of got their start with us: Mark Twain, Henry James. The founders, James Russell Lowell, just these really...
So it's an amazing...
Yeah.
It's got an amazing history.
Definitely.
But then it went through a little bit of turmoil, right? When it used to always be in Boston.
Exactly,
traditionally,
yeah.
100 years, I guess, in Boston. And then were you involved in the move to D.C.?
I was involved in the sense that I got a job out of the move. A lot of people didn't make the move. This was actually right when I started in 2005. The owner of the company is now based in D.C. He bought the magazine about a little more than 10 years ago, and he already had other publications in the Watergate building, which is where I go to work every day, which is kind of surreal. So he decided it just made more sense to move everyone down. So it did kind of change the culture a bit. I think for 150 years, it had been a very New England publication. I don't know if anyone listening watches the show Mad Men, but one of the characters in, this was in the 60s, wrote a story for The Atlantic, and it had some hilarious name like Tapping a Maple on a Snowy Vermont Morning. And I think that title was supposed to be kind of a caricature of what The Atlantic was thought to be for a really long time, of just this, very thoughtful literary, but, just kind of, I don't want to say stuffy, but, a certain kind of New England sensibility. And, I mean, I love that. I love that that strand in the history. But when it moved to D.C., the culture of the place did change. It became a little more political and just more. I think the strand that the editors picked up is this idea of ideas, really, of having big ideas and asking kind of contrarian questions and more of that rather than sort of snowy maple trees in Vermont.
So, I think sometime maybe after the move, The Atlantic was profiled in the New York Times, and it noted that. The magazine was struggling, as all magazines were during that period. But it sounds like The Atlantic, and from looking at the website, it looks like The Atlantic really rose from the ashes. I mean, I don't know how dire the situation was, but it clearly went through a rebirth. And the New York Times says that was because of a cultural transfusion, a dose of counterintuition, and a lot of digital advertising revenue. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that sort of ties into what I was saying before about, I think what's happened at The Atlantic really has paralleled what's happened in media in general, but you can really see it clearly where I work, just that ebb and flow of all this creativity with no money behind it, then a crunch down to almost nothing on the website of things, and then suddenly this new infusion of money and just really advertising ingenuity. And I think it's both things. I think we have a really smart editor on the website who came from Wired magazine, where he was basically running the magazine there for a long time, for a decade. And he's really creative and very energetic, and he's attracted a lot of just really smart young people. And he just energizes everyone to feel like we're just doing this really cool, groundbreaking new thing every single day. So I think, there's that. And then, he's really good at working with the advertising team, keeping, the editorial product separate, but also just, finding new ways that we can make money. For example,
how does a magazine make money today?
Well, the magazine is, I can't speak as much for the print product. That's a whole other thing. But I could say on the website, a lot of it has to do with just showing that we're doing really good stuff and winning awards. And then we attract high level advertisers like Apple, or people that might not have been as interested in tapping a maple tree in Vermont on a snowy morning, that sort of thing. So kind of just making the brand a little more current and hip. And then, just finding ways to take what we're already doing and packaging it differently. So, one thing he did was, we have these different sections of the website. You mentioned that I'm overseeing. One of the things I do is I oversee the national channel on the site. So we have, things are broken into the entertainment channel and the technology channel and the politics channel. That makes it easier.
I guess I don't understand the concept of a channel on a website. Is that just like you click on it and you get
that page? Yeah, we call it, exactly.
So you're calling it a channel instead of a page.
Yeah, it's really just like a section, but it's a way to gather all the stuff. So before that, we had this sort of intermediary period where we had bloggers, some really high-profile bloggers like Andrew Sullivan, who and that was where most of our original content was coming from. But it's really hard to sell that to advertisers because, first of all, you never know what a blogger is going to say.
Yeah, that's true.
And also, just it's kind of random. Like one of the cool things about our bloggers is that one day, like one of our writers, Ta-Nehisi Coates, just as an example, he might write about the Civil War one day, and then he might write about hip hop, or he might write about football or video games, or So it's having these different what we call channels. Makes it easier so an advertiser can say, oh, I'm interested in technology, so I want to put our ads next to everything about technology. So suddenly, they have a place to sell their
advertising. So then there's a technology channel.
Yeah. And one thing our boss, Bob Cohen, he's also done is he wants all of these channels to be really innovative. So, you know, a technology section of a website could just be, you know, gadgets and new product reviews. And I mean, that has its place too, but he found a guy, a young, really creative guy who is also from Wired, who just has all these sort of deep, interesting thoughts about technology, or just he writes cool stuff about, you know, record players from the 1900s, early 1900s. You know, it's just a pretty broad range. And I think on all the channels, that's, you know, one thing that's really working well, is giving a twist, you know, making these subjects a little different than what you see other places.
Okay, I want to backtrack a little bit. So I noticed that recently there was an award given by the American Bar Association, the Silver Gavel. So you're a Silver Gavel honoree for 2012. Does that mean you, as the editor, are the person who's the honoree? Is it the article? Is it your commentary on somebody? Like, no, I didn't understand what that was.
That is an amazing writer named Andrew Cohen, who's one of my favorite writers on the site. It's for his coverage of death penalty. So he's done really amazing work. I'm technically his editor, but he doesn't need a whole lot of editing. I just post really carefully, and you know, I'll copy edit it, and if I have some questions, I'll ask him, and he'll rework little things. But he's a fantastic writer.
So then the reason you're listed is because they have the name of the article, and then him as the author, and then your editor, and you as the editor of that section.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
But that was a big honor.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's having people like him to write for us is really what makes this job exciting.
No, I didn't, wasn't able to completely finish that article in preparation for this interview, but I started reading. It looked really interesting because it was reflecting on Supreme Court cases and assumptions that Supreme Court judges were making that he was challenging.
So oh, yeah, that was his latest piece for us after the healthcare ruling. He wrote about that.
So that was really interesting. Okay, so in terms of what your day-to-day work is like, what is it that you do?
That's one of the fun things about this job. It's a lot of different stuff. So some of what I do, as you mentioned, I produce the online version of the magazine. So some of that's just kind of, you know, tedious, getting things in place, kind of table of contents, that kind of stuff. But a lot of it's just trying to find ways to enrich whatever's in the print magazine for the website. So making it more interactive.
You create videos.
Yeah, that's kind of a funny
thing.
That's
so cool.
That I never thought I would do, but I've been doing it for years now. You know, just, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago, when this expansion was starting to happen, you know, it became clear that they wanted more multimedia on the site, and I'd never really done that, a little tiny bit at Berkeley, but I just said, well, you know, I'll just get cameras and do something.
Did you just learn by doing it?
Yeah, I had, like, you know, you can buy these these kind of courses you can do for Final Cut Pro that come with DVDs. I took one class in it for advanced Final Cut Pro editing, but it turns out if you're an editor, it's not that hard to do video editing. Now, I want to say video filming is different. It's been a challenge for me to cultivate my visual skills because I'm not a photographer, an artist, and, you know, you really have to learn to look at lighting and all that. So, I mean, that's a whole other thing. I've definitely been, I've grown a lot in that, but I think editing, if you're used to editing print, you know, it's not that different. The only difference, and, you know, here at a radio station, I guess it's kind of similar that, you know, if you want to edit this interview later and I didn't actually say any of those words, that you can't put them in, you know. I mean, you could try to chop around and try to find some place where I said and I said but, or, you know. But it's the same with video, that, you know, you can't add something that wasn't already there. But I mean, otherwise, it's basically the same. You're just trying to tell a good story and trying to find the parts that can be put
That's
together
cool.
best.
Now, I have to admit, the only video that I saw that you made was the one that you made for your husband for Father's Day.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was really cute. So there's these advantages to developing these new skills.
Fringe benefit, right?
Okay, so what other... So you make these videos,
make
you
videos.
Shoot them, you edit them, and then you post them on the Atlantic Nation
or just
channel?
For that part of my job, it's just across the site. So it might be a politics video or an entertainment video. It's just, the main thing is it goes with a magazine article.
How do you make that decision what you're going to spend your time on? Like, well, should I make a video for this? Or, like, does someone request, oh, we'd like a video in this area today?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think, so I go to the meetings every week that with the print magazine staff. And then, you know, I'll listen to what's coming down the pike. And then sometimes it's pretty obvious. Like, we have a cover story right now that's just huge. It's called Why Women Still Can't Have It All.
I saw there were a lot of hits.
Yeah, it's breaking all our records. It's a brilliant article. And we knew ahead of time that it was going to get a lot of attention. So when you have something like that, you just think, okay, let's ride on the coattails of this. Let's do everything. And not just, you know, to get the traffic, but because there's a lot of interesting discussion we could frame around it. So for that, I knew we wanted a video. I knew we wanted to have other writers weighing in and, you know, debating the premise. And I knew we wanted to have a live chat with the author where she would come online and talk to our readers. So, you know, all of those things were pretty obvious to set up. And this other times it's just, you know, like it's something that lends itself to visuals. For example, we have a piece coming up about how women in Fox News wear more makeup than on other channels. You know, so something like that makes a good slideshow.
Oh, right. That makes sense.
Yeah. Or, you know, something, you know, we had an article about Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, and how he just adores Bruce Springsteen, even though it's unrequited love, because Bruce doesn't really like him very much. So that lends itself to having this.
Politics are a little different.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, there's fun things you can do with that online. So some of it's that. And then sometimes it's just, you know, there's just someone has a writer or an editor from the print side will just say, we have this really cool extra footage. There was this really interesting article about a policewoman who was just convicted of murder. She's a police detective, and turned out she'd committed a murder, according to the jury. But so that it turned out we had all this footage of her interrogation where she didn't even realize she was a suspect. And little by little, you watch her realize that she's being, you know, interrogated. So that's something like when they just happen to have really good extra material, it's fun to get that ready.
Do you feel ever sort of, I don't want to say deranged, but you know, like you're going in all different directions because there's so much you could do? It sounds like that your job is really interesting because it's so multifaceted, but how do you keep straight what you should be doing at any given time?
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge, well, especially because of, like, the other part of what I do is this day-to-day stuff on the national section of the website. So, I mean, that's also, I mean, that in itself can it be anything from, as you mentioned, editing pieces about the death penalty or about gay marriage or but just all these different kinds of national issues, religion. So every day I just kind of have to figure out what's more urgent. You know, what is the magazine getting published tomorrow? If so, I have to drop everything and finish that up. Or is it, you know, is this a really newsworthy article? Is there something in the news that's going to be not as interesting tomorrow? And then I should get this up today. So it's all just about the urgency of any one piece of the puzzle.
Okay. And do you miss writing longer pieces yourself? Do you have any time to do that?
That's a really good question. I do. I do miss that. And I don't have a lot of time for it.
Because you were an award winner. Tell us about, I believe you won an early award for, was it the travel piece that you wrote?
Well, you mentioned the Lonely Planet anthology. I had a travel piece in there. That was great. And but my previous job, I actually did more reporting, kind of long form writing. And I do miss that. But you know that right now, as a mom of a toddler, it's kind of actually better to have smaller projects because those longer articles take a lot of a lot of times you have to travel to do the reporting. And, you know, you really have to get absorbed in a way that's kind of, you know, day
yeah, I can
and night.
See that, because you'd also have to mull over your content and think about, whereas if you know you're just, oh, I'm making this video and then I'm editing the video and then I'm going to do, you know, edit this article, it's a task that you can immediately get into and then let go, as opposed to writing a long thing.
Right, and at the end of the day, like, or end of a couple of days, you're done with that particular task, as opposed to, you could ask my husband, Jonathan, about, you know, the times when I was writing longer articles. I think a lot of writers go through this. It'd just be, I'd usually be in tears at some point in the process, and, you know, it's just, you need so much undisturbed space, and there's always a point where it's like it's perfect in your head before you sit down to write it, and then somewhere in the middle you're thinking, wait, this isn't the way it was supposed to sound.
Oh, that's so interesting. I'm just reading, I think it's Jonathan Lehrer's book, Imagine, about creativity, and he posits that as a, maybe not even posits it, but he asserts that part of the creative process is this period of real frustration where you just don't think you can get what you want to get, and that triggers some certain part of your brain that then feeds you the creativity of something like creative blending, some blending of different parts of your thought processes, which enables you to reach this higher level of creativity.
I like that. You know, it's funny too, one thing I really love about my job is I have access to a lot of really, you know, pretty famous,
you
accomplished writers.
Absolutely do. I was just trying to find information about you, so I typed in your name and interview, and of course there's all the people you interviewed and nothing about you, but so many interesting people you get to talk to.
Well, so that's how I get to pick their brains. And about writing, and this is one of the things I love asking our writers is, you know, do you enjoy writing? Do you actually enjoy the process of writing? And, you know, the answers are really interesting. I think there are some writers who imagine themselves to be writers with like a capital W, and I mean, a lot of times these are beautiful, beautiful writers, but that, you know, they just have a really high opinion of their own prose, and that, you know, they for them, you know, their writing and the wording and all of that is primary, and whatever the subject matter is kind of secondary to that. And then there's another kind of writer, like James Fallows, who is, by the way, a fantastic human being. I don't know how he's stayed so nice doing, you know, being a journalist all these years. He hasn't gotten hardened or crusty. Yeah, but he's a wonderful person. But he says he really, you know, doesn't enjoy the process of writing. He it's an excuse for him to learn and to just have a life of exploring and talking to cool people and synthesizing information. But it just, you know, he finds it really hard to just sit down and have to, he quotes his friend Hendrik Hertzberg, who writes for The New Yorker, who said something like that spontaneous quality that comes after the 14th revision. So I think there's a range in that way.
I want to remind listeners, you're listening to Writers' Voices at KRUU 100.1 FM. I am Cheryl Fusco Johnson, your host today. And with me, I have a fabulous hometown girl back as our guest, hometown woman. Her name is Jenny Rothenberg Gritz. She works for The Atlantic and has a job where it requires a lot of multifaceted talents, all of which she has in spades. And she's telling us a little bit about her work at The Atlantic. So what are some of the memorable interviews that you've had? Sounds like Harold Bloom. Mm-hmm. That must have been a big one.
Yeah, you mentioned that. That was so much fun. That was back right at the very beginning when I was just starting out.
Had you possibly studied him as an undergraduate? So it sounds like that was a person you were really eager to talk to.
Yeah, and I mean, anyone who knows about Harold Bloom knows he's got a reputation for being a character. He definitely didn't disappoint. He talks like he's out of some 19th century book. And he's kind of controversial because he's so into the classics and he really doesn't like the newer trends in literature to be more inclusive and focus on women or different ethnicities.
Well, it must have been a shock for him to read Harry Potter. So the way that he's gotten really into current controversy is by kind of bashing the Harry Potter books.
Exactly.
But I'm sure it was a shock to him after reading Chaucer and Shakespeare and being so immersed. And he's been teaching for like 50 years.
Yeah,
teaching
exactly.
Classics. So
what was amazing about him was, we talked a lot about deconstructionism or post-structuralism, these theories that basically say language has no meaning, these kind of existential theories that, you know, there is no inherent meaning in the word or in language at all. And then on the other side, he's really interested in Kabbalah, this sort of, the Jewish mysticism, which puts so much meaning into every word, kind of in a way like the idea of Sanskrit and, the idea that the sound itself has the meaning intertwined with it, so he calls it like a plenitude of a meaning.
So two completely opposing theories.
Exactly. But, I thought it was so interesting that he said that he thinks in the end these are really the same. And so, I think for a lot of us in Fairfield, that doesn't sound so crazy that the complete emptiness is the same as complete fullness. But, I was fascinated that he said that. So I asked him to elaborate, and he said that he just thinks the absolute with a capital A is what matters in both cases. If it's absolutely devoid of meaning or absolutely full of meaning, it's the fact that there is something completely absolute.
That's really interesting. I had a quote from him from your interview with him, and if I can find it, I wanted you to comment on this. So at the end of the article, you quoted him as saying, "I believe firmly that in the end, all useful criticism is based upon experience, an experience of teaching, an experience of reading, one's experience of writing, and most of all, one's experience of living. Just as wisdom in the end is purely personal, there can be no method except the self."
Mm-hmm.
That was a great ending quote for you to land on. And I'm wondering, do you feel that that applies not just to the area of literary criticism, but could you say that that applies to your own career at The Atlantic or other aspects of life?
Yeah. Well, can you read that? Can you read the last couple sentences again? Actually, that's...
Let's see. Experience. All useful criticism, but we're just positing that's all useful in different fields of endeavor, are based upon experience, an experience of teaching, an experience of reading, one's experience of writing, and most of all, one's experience of living. So do you think, because it sounds like you couldn't really get completely prepared for what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you went to Berkeley or you went to Marishi University of Management, you didn't know what your job was going to end up being.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you draw the wisdom to work with all these different, you're working with 20 somethings, you're working with Harold Bloom.
Well, not usually,
like really experienced people.
Right.
So, what prepared you to do all this?
It's interesting hearing you read this. I hadn't looked back on this interview for a long time, but those words of his strike me really differently now than they did 10 years
interesting.
Ago. Because I have more life experience. No, I think that's definitely true. I think, and I wish I'd known this when I was younger too, I think there's just a kind of confidence that just comes from being alive longer and having different experiences, and nothing can replicate that. I work with a lot of super smart, confident kids who are right out of Ivy League schools, and yeah, I'm kind of in awe of how confident they are, especially in this culture today of blogging where it's all about just kind of Obama gives a speech and then you blog about why he was wrong. It's kind of audacious, you know, but there's that certain kind of confidence that I do admire of just knowing that you're really smart and have something to say. But there's a different kind of confidence that just comes from knowing you've done this and you did it successfully. You know, you made a video and it worked, and you made 10 videos and they worked, and you spoke to some high level person like Harold Bloom and it was really cool and you had a great conversation. So, you know, you can do that again. You know, so I think you're right that there's just a really calm, settled kind of confidence that comes over time when you just know you can do all these different things.
Experience. But when you first spoke to him, mm-hmm. you weren't at that stage yet.
No, and I mean, I think to some extent, even now a little bit, you know, I always had knots in my stomach before I was about to talk to someone really important. And I mean, I think growing up here helped really prepared me to feel like I did have unique things to bring out. You know, I think it was really gratifying to go out in the world and have people say, wow, that was a really profound question. And I knew it was only because I grew up around people who thought that way. You know, it's the way people think here is not the way people think out there. You know, when I went to Berkeley, I actually had a work study job for the humanities department, and you know, everything's so fragmented out there that it's all about, let's look and see if Walt Whitman is homosexual, or let's see if Huck and the Runaway Slave were sleeping on the raft together naked, so what does that mean? Or, you know, they just sort of find some lens, or is it about feminism, or is it about, you know, and a lot of these are very noble causes in themselves, but this sort of looking at the deepest level and finding connections between things, that's not always so common out in the world. So I think, I was able to bring that to it. But I mean, still, I felt, you know, I was definitely nervous to think, you know, I'm going to talk to Harold Bloom. What am I going to be able to bring to this conversation that he hasn't heard a million times before? So,
well, what do you think are the qualities of a good interviewer?
I love that question. I wish more people would ask that. You know, it's funny because unless you're doing a Q&A, which you're doing very, very wonderfully right now, unless you're listening to that kind of a format or like on NPR, you know, you don't really know if someone's a good interviewer just by reading a reported piece. You see the quotes that they have. But, I mean, interviewing is usually done behind closed doors. So when you read a New Yorker article, for example, you don't know if the person who was writing the article was able to develop a really good rapport with the people. You know, it's hard to know. But I think someone once gave me advice that you should really like the person you're talking to while you're talking to them. and this is something that's been really interesting, because sometimes I interview people, I go into it really not liking their viewpoints on something. Like I recently interviewed an evangelical preacher who runs an organization for gay evangelical people who basically don't want to be gay anymore. And, you know, I have to just say that that's at my very core, that just, I don't like that idea at all. But I was really excited to get to talk to him and see what the nuances were, if there were any, and where he was coming from. And so, but you know, it was pretty easy to like him while I was talking to him. And I still had my questions and I still had my, you know, challenges to him, just like, but you know, but I didn't close myself off to him. You know, I listened to what he was saying and I took it in, and I, you know, and also just, you know, the ability to not just have everything written down on note cards, but to hear someone say something interesting and then say, oh, what did you mean by that? You know, I think that's a big part of it.
I agree with that. I think that's interesting what you're saying, that for your job, you're interviewing people that you might not invite to dinner at your house, you know, who think a lot differently than you. But that seems like that's almost becoming a lost art, to be able to talk to people whose views are completely different than yours.
Mm-hmm.
And keeping that alive seems really important to me.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm really not, just being in journalism, I'm really not interested in the kind of journalism that preaches to the choir, because you see so much out there that it just fires up the people who already agree with you and it pisses off the people who don't agree with you, and nothing gets accomplished by that, you know. So I think, yeah.
Well, you certainly don't ever convince someone of your viewpoint if you're antagonizing each other.
Yeah,
there's no communication.
Exactly, yeah. No communication. And as an editor, that's something I try to work on when I get a piece that sort of editorializes too much, or it takes, you know, it sort of has a sentence that's just going to alienate people who don't agree. I tell the writer, I think we need to change that. You know, that's
interesting.
Not accomplish
now, is it hard to be an editor? Like, we always, where I am, I always hear like writers, you know, complaining about the editor, or mostly actually, I know a lot of children's writers in this area, and mostly they're very happy with their editors mm-hmm. and the editing process. But what's it like on the other side of the desk? Because you've been on both sides.
Yeah, and I think having been on the other side makes me a more sensitive editor, because I've been edited badly, and it's a terrible feeling when you turn in a 3,000-word piece and it comes back 1,300 words completely choppy, or when your voice gets changed so you sound like you're writing a Nancy Drew story when you're writing about the Holocaust. Or, you know, it's really, you know, I've had some bad experiences with that. So I mean, I think number one, I try to be really sensitive to the voice of the writer. You know, I tell them if I add in a sentence, I put a little note in, you know, track changes and word and say, please feel free to reword this. This is just an idea I think you should get across here. So I never want them to feel like their voice is being changed. And then, you know, I think when you're edited by, you know, carefully, I think it's really flattering because you feel like someone's just entered this little world with you. As a writer, you've just spent however many hours or days or weeks immersed in this story, and then someone just comes in there with you and they're just as interested as you are, and they're reading carefully enough that they can sharpen every little point. You know, I think that's actually a very flattering experience as a writer if it's done right. So that's what I try to do, and I'm always gratified when the writers seem to feel that it was that way.
Just as we talked about what makes a good interviewer, so what makes a good editor?
I think a lot of the same things, because both of those are about not having your own agenda, and I think also I edit a lot of pieces I don't agree with too, and I have to make them better. I mean, I guess I'm revealing my politics a little bit here, but you know, I'll have right-wing think tanks send me, you know, pieces about family values and, you know, in certain ways that I might not necessarily agree with, but I want their argument to be strong because, again, I don't want them just preaching to the choir and annoying everybody. And you know, I feel like if I'm helping them say what they're trying to say clearly enough, then, you know, people who don't agree with them will understand better why.
Yeah, it furthers the communication.
Exactly.
So it advances the communication between the parties, anyway.
Yeah, I think I think that's a big part of it. And I think, just little things like looking for mixed metaphors, people just kind of get sloppy, like they don't realize that they use the word, scintillating, which has to do with something visual, and then they used a word that maybe is an audio metaphor, you know, like they don't realize that they just mixed two totally different things together, or, you know, cliches. My boss is really anti-cliche. I think there's a place for cliches when you're using them subversively, but, you know, he's just, if he sees a cliche in a piece, he'll send us an email, cliche. So, that, and I think, word choice. And then just sometimes it's just you realize there's just some really powerful point that they buried. They buried the lead, as we say, mm-hmm. I just got a piece in about, I feel like I'm mentioning gay marriage a lot because we've had a few pieces on that recently, but we had an interesting piece about a town in Minnesota that's kind of a conservative suburb of St. Paul where everyone's flying rainbow flags to support gay marriage because there's a vote coming up on a new amendment. And, she didn't start describing the little church ladies who were doing this until the middle of the piece. She started out with some rhetoric about gay marriage and stuff we already know from the news. And I said, no, I want to see this neighborhood right up front. That's what makes
it kind of personalized in the beginning, so people have something they can relate to in a more visceral way, I would imagine.
Yeah, and I think, exactly. And I think the key with communicating that to the writer is showing them it's already in there. Like it's kind of a tricky relationship as an editor because you're kind of basically saying you put all this work into it, but I know how you can make it better than you already did. Yeah. You know, so that's kind of.
Do you imagine yourself ever teaching?
Yeah, I've taught a couple courses at MUM and I loved it. I definitely could. I think.
What did you teach at MUM?
I taught an introductory to literature course, so that was great. I got to teach basically whatever I wanted, just touching on a lot of the major areas. And then I taught a class called Literature and the Environment, which. Again, I had a lot of leeway. Terry Fairchild, the head of the department, was just really great, and he let me create my own syllabus. And, I taught everything from an Edgar Allan Poe story about being sucked into an abyss to, you know, just Thoreau and just John Muir and Jack Kerouac got into the syllabus.
So what would you like to teach now? Would you want to be teaching literature? Would you want to be teaching writing?
Well, I think... a lot of the subjects we're talking about are what I have the most experience in now, you know, writing, editing and interviewing and just the sort of specifics of online journalism compared to the old print model. So I think those would be the most natural things for me to teach at this point. But I mean, I love literature. I'll always love literature, too.
It doesn't seem like you have time in your schedule right now to do any teaching.
Yeah, not at the moment, but who knows? I mean, I definitely see that as a piece of the puzzle for later
sometime.
In life. Yeah.
Do you see yourself eventually writing books?
Yeah, I think, it's funny you asked that. I think I've always seen myself as writing books, but as you get older, you kind of, I found that once I got into my 30s, something switch kind of happened where I realized, like, yeah, I'm not rehearsing for my life, I'm actually living my life
it right now.
It's a really great life, and I'd love it maybe later on when my kids are older if I, if I have the time to do that, I would love to plunge more deeply into a project like that, but, I right now I'm just actually enjoying what I'm doing.
Yeah, you've got a lot going on with a little one.
Yeah.
So I mentioned books and writing books. There's a lot changing, not just with magazines, but also with books. And I was interested in one of the articles as I was flipping through, you know, what was in The Atlantic today. There was an article about the end of law reviews, mm-hmm. which, you know, I was on Law Review, and I had a Law Review article, and I remember what that process was like. And there was the man who wrote the article, let's see, Olson, he said something, yeah, do you remember who that was?
His last name was Olson. He's a one-time writer. He's part of a series we're doing. Yeah.
The articles was like, abolish law reviews.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting. But he talked about, this is a quote from that article, as online law writing has taken off, readers are rewarding qualities like clarity, concision, relevance, and wit, and steering clear of pedantry and mystification. And I remember my own law review article, and I think it might have had, you know, 100 footnotes. Mm-hmm. And even now, if I read what I had written myself, I would probably be a little bit challenged to follow it all. But what do you think about the difference between having the time and the complete focus to write a law review article, which took months, as opposed to writing legal commentary with wit and very concisely, but getting responding immediately? Mm-hmm. Like, what's lost and what's gained in that process?
That's such a good question. Actually, I recently filmed a video with Andrew Sullivan, who's used to write for us, but he's a pretty famous blogger who's speaking to James Fallows. And you know, he's written beautiful books, really gorgeous books, but he's just like a crazily prolific blogger just for the past, I don't know, 10, 15 years, just, you know, tons and tons of posts a day. And he says he does feel like he's losing the ability to think deeply and to write, you know, it's that kind of deeper, you know, substantive thing you're talking about. So I mean, that on the one hand, he's having this really amazing relationship in this real time, you know, way with people all over the world, where he'll write something and then they'll write back and then he'll engage with them and he'll correct what he was saying. You know, there's that kind of
just give and take.
Give and take, and just being able to write something and then 10 minutes later say you were wrong, you know, in real time. Just so there, I mean, that's all really exciting. And like you said, the internet does reward being concise and, you know, sharp and all that. So I think that's all really good. But yeah, you know, there is
It seems like one of the things that's gained to me, mm-hmm. excuse me for interrupting
you,
is like the crowd. You know, mm-hmm. you get the, not in a bad sense, the crowd, but that kind of intelligence that comes from crowdsourcing, kind of mm-hmm. getting everybody putting in some thoughts and mixing it all together and having that back and forth, which is much different than writing a law review article in your cubicle on the third floor of the, you know, the law school building.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think, yes, although if you write an article, at least for, I think for most websites, definitely for us, you can't take the commenters too seriously, because usually the ones who are the most obnoxious write first. But so there's that.
Well, those are the ones it's most fun to respond to,
yeah,
I'm sure they get.
That's true.
But something like the article that you just did with on the motherhood, and mm-hmm. what was the name of that article again?
The one, recent one about the attachment parenting article?
Or? No, the one about the generational shift, like what the early feminists did, mm-hmm. and what the generation, like their daughters thought, and then what the young people today.
Why women today still can't have it all. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That was a really, let's talk about that article for a little bit.
I mean, I'd love to talk about that. That's actually been consuming a lot of my time because, yeah, as I mentioned, I've been doing online accompaniments for that are just keep coming.
Before we get into that deeply, let me just remind listeners, this is Writers' Voices. I'm Cheryl Fusco Johnson, your host. We're hosted by KRUU 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. And I almost can't even speak in my excitement because we have such a great guest today. It's Jenny Rothenberg-Gritz, and she works for The Atlantic, and we're talking about one of the stories that's really lighting up the screens of many people. So this balance, like, can women really balance mm-hmm. motherhood and career?
Yeah, I think this is kind of, in a way, the quintessential Atlantic article, in the sense that it's all about an idea. You know, it's not just a narrative story about some woman doing, it's like, you know, it's an argument, and it's a lot about who she is. It's written by a woman who was the head of the foreign policy school at Princeton. She's still a very, very powerful academic, but she was invited by Hillary Clinton to be the director of policy planning for the State Department, and that was her dream job. That's what she always wanted to do. So she was doing that. She had to move. She had to come down to D.C. from Princeton for 5 days a week and then go home. And her husband, she had the kind of dream situation where she had a husband who was completely involved and ready to take on more than his share at home while she did this.
But they also had teenage boys.
They had teenage boys, exactly. And one of her sons, and she says he was fine with having her write about this, but she gets pretty, you know, personal about how he just was really in trouble and he really needed her. I think, it's really engaged people because of who she is. You know, it's not this whole question of whether women can really ever have work-life balance. That's not new at all. But I think what's new in her case is she's saying that, you know, feminists, in a way, we've made each other feel guilty as women because
you're trying to meet these very high standards of doing it all,
right? And it makes people feel like they don't want it enough, or they're not ambitious enough. Like if a woman is
creative enough to make it all work, innovative.
Yeah, and if a woman's at a law firm and she decides not to go on the partner track and just to take up, like, to work at a nonprofit that lets her see her kids more, you know, that she's considered to be letting all other women down. You know, but meanwhile, it's a real problem that when you get to the top of any, you know, field, there aren't a lot of women represented. You know, in all the Fortune 500 companies, or even in the government, the women who are there usually have kids who are grown, or they don't have kids, or they're just have, you know, five nannies and they're working around the clock. And so she, you know, she's just saying it's, you know, I think part of what's making this controversial is the very idea that there is any difference between men and women gets a lot of people fired up in
terms of parenting.
Yeah, just like partly. If you're completely equal partners and the husband's going to be this enlightened, supportive husband, then, you know, you shouldn't be talking about women. You should just be talking about people having work-life balance. But her point is that you can say that all you want, but when you get to these top levels, women are just less willing than men to sacrifice their family lives. You know, men, there just are more men who will come home after the kids are asleep night after night. And women, you know, just fewer women are willing to do that. It's interesting. She talks a lot about Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook, who she gave a speech at Barnard at the commencement address where she fired all the women up and said, you know, don't start your career thinking that you're going to have babies, so you have to be on the slow track. You know, just put your foot to the gas, lean forward, you know, raise your hand, just be engaged. I've seen too many women pull back because they just assume they're going to be on some kind of mommy track later in life. So, I think it was a great speech, and the girls were really inspired. But meanwhile, Sheryl, what she didn't say is that she leaves work at 5:30 every night so she can be home with her kids. So our writer, Anne-Marie
found
Slaughter,
that out.
Yeah, well, I think it came out later, like after, you know, like there was something that came out. She's saying that's what she should have said. You know, she shouldn't have just fired them up to be ambitious and work hard. She should have also said, and by the way, I leave work at 5:30, and don't be afraid to
set some boundaries.
Yeah, set boundaries, and we need a new archetype of the successful woman who who works hard, who's incredible. Actually, one of the interesting responses we had on the website was by Eileen Fisher, who she's actually an advertiser. It was written, you know how when you're reading a magazine and it'll say special advertising section? It was sort of like that kind of post. It was actually kind of a sponsored post, like by an advertiser, but I found it really interesting because she spoke about starting her clothing line and how she just got it to the point where she was so efficient that she could work from 9 to 3 a few days a week, and she did it by just, you know, not doing the water cooler talk and not doing the kind of
just being really focused.
It's true. Like I think, you know, a lot of bosses put a high premium on the people who stay till 7 o'clock at night, but you know, what are those people really doing? Are they spending all that time super?
You're really working, or some of that time, something like surfing
around
the internet, or.
Exactly. Yeah.
One aspect seems to me that there's a lot more longevity, or there has been, and it seems like there might be time to have a more measured career while your kids are at home and continue working. We're seeing a lot of people now working in their 60s and 70s and being happy to do that, other people like having to do that. Mm-hmm. So do you have any comments about your generation and what you think about those sort of strategies?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. That's a point in our cover story too, and I think it's something I hadn't really thought of before, but this idea that we don't have to be in as much of a rush, and that, you know, that this idea of having a career plateau for a while where you think, look, I have a kid at home, like I don't need to be, you know, you asked if I wanted to write books, for example, I'd love to at some point, but you know, I don't need to have this sense of urgency, like I need to write a book by the time I'm 40, you know, because life is long, and unless you're a figure skater or a gymnast or some profession where you have to be really young, you know, you can be doing awesome stuff in your 50s and your 60s, and I think it's, you know, part of it is just feeling like you're in the game, because I think it's hard, especially for a lot of women, to be out of the workplace altogether and then come back when they're 50 and get hired. So I mean, that's still a problem that has to be sorted out by society, but I think putting your career on maybe a more of a sort of a even keel for a while and not trying to knock yourself out, and then knowing that later there'll be time for that. I think that's important.
Trying to be calm about it. So do you see any big changes in the Atlantic?
Yeah. Well, I mean, coming
forward. Yeah. Like well, I guess you've seen changes already happen. Are there any things like directions that you see it heading?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it's changed so much more than I ever would have thought when I took this job. I think, it's going to be interesting what happens with iPads, but just in publishing in general. Yeah, you know, I remember when I was at Berkeley 12 years ago, people were predicting, the professors thought the paper would be gone within a few years. That hasn't happened. I mean, I think people still like to curl up with a paper magazine. But on the other hand, there's something really efficient about just owning this one tablet and getting all your magazines on that, and you know, it, being able to push a button and watch a video while you're in the middle of reading the article. You know, so it'll be interesting to see whether paper and receiving stuff through the mail really continues.
I had my son Eric on, whom you know, recently, and we talked about the same thing. And our conclusion was, we both felt that there'll be a lot of different formats. And he had just created a book called How to Make a Book with iBooks Author. So he knows a lot about, you know, electronic publishing, but he also has handmade books, which is one of the things he did at Brown. And his feeling was that there would be like art books, there'll be some things people are always going to want in paper. And I sort of feel that way about magazines. Is that what some of the people in print magazines feel, that it is kind of nice to have? I don't know, it is true, it's nice to travel with electronic media, like if you're, you know, going to go on a plane or something, you can carry a lot of books with you on your iPad or any other thoughts you have on that? As a new mom, how do you feel, like, what age are you going to be exposing your child to media as opposed to picture books?
Well, we've already done it a little more than we probably should have. Obviously it's a question that Jonathan and I ask each other a lot, that our parents never really had to deal with. I mean, there was always the question of whether you're allowed to watch TV. That was about as far as it went. But yeah, I was actually feeling really nostalgic the other day, because I was remembering how, you know, I'd come home and have dinner with my parents and talk about what I did at school, and my dad would go get the World Book Encyclopedia and bring it to the table, and it was so cool. You know, it's such a great way to bring what I was learning one step further. And you know, there aren't really encyclopedias anymore, and I don't really want to create a situation where we're Googling stuff on our iPhones
at dinner.
Dinner conversation.
It's a little different.
But I mean, my husband and I will sometimes play a little video for our son in the car when he's cranky. They actually make these amazing interactive children's books of Pat the Bunny, where you can, like, you know, you remember how on the old Pat the Bunny has like a little flap you can lift, and now you touch the screen and the flap goes up, or you can pop the bubbles by touching the screen. And
I've seen kids with a print book trying to poke the print and make it do something, so books are going to be pretty boring for them, I guess.
I mean, my 18-month-old learned the word iPhone before he learned almost any other word, which is kind of sad, but it's something we have to think about.
Are there any other things coming that you want to, or what would you like of your readers? Does it seem to you that readers are becoming fragmented, you know? Because in the old days of, say, news, you know, there were three networks. Everybody was looking at those same three networks. But now we can kind of choose, do we want to read The Atlantic, or do we want to read something a lot different? And our paths may not cross. Are there things that you're doing at The Atlantic to have kind of diversity in readership?
Yeah, I mean, The Atlantic's kind of in a cool position in that way, because we've never been one of these, you know, really firmly aligned with any. I think our founding mission was of no party or clique.
Oh, really? That was part of the actual mission statement?
Exactly. I mean, to be honest, like, you know, there aren't a lot of, you know, Fox News types who work for us. We have a certain kind of coherence there, but, you know, we have libertarians, and we have really, you know, people who are much more liberal in their economic, you know, we do have a range of viewpoints. So, I mean, I think we do attract a lot of different people. But, I mean, it does make it interesting as a writer and an editor and just a producer of content to get it out there, because you have this one piece that's kind of going to go out all by itself into the ether. And you just hope that if you give it a provocative headline and it, you know, you just angle it right, it's going to take off. And it's kind of a weird experience. I guess musicians probably have a similar feeling. They used to create albums, and now they just, each song is like its own little entity, you know. It's different.
Oh, it has its own life on the web. It can appear in many different places.
Yeah, this is not like creating a in the contrast, if you're a subscriber to The Atlantic, you've kind of already bought into the idea that this magazine is good, and I'm going to get the whole thing every month, all 20 articles, and whatever is in there, I'll just skim through it and read. It's just like, you know, like an old record album would have been. So, I mean, it's kind of, the web is more like that kind of iTunes model.
Yeah, that's a great analogy.
Yeah.
So, what kinds of media do you personally engage in, either, like, let's say for your job, do you use Twitter much on your job?
We have a full-time social media person actually who works for us.
So you don't have to do that part of it?
Not as much. I mean, I have started tweeting more, which, you know, it's it's kind of a, in some ways it's funny, like when I first started doing this in my early 20s, I was the hippest, most plugged in person. Now I kind of have to look to my younger colleagues for, you know, guidance on what
things like Pinterest or,
yeah, exactly,
you know, new things coming up.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I'm glad I have this job, because I would be a ridiculous fuddy-duddy if I didn't. I mean, this keeps me plugged in, both in terms of the news cycle and also in terms of all the cool technology.
Do you engage much with, I would guess, mm-hmm, fans of the magazine?
Yeah, I mean, D.C., I think, has probably a higher per capita number of people reading it, you know, reading the Atlantic online than a lot of places do, because it's all these kind of 20 and 30-something professional, you know, intellectuals who come there to do these policy jobs and stuff. So I like at dinner parties, I'll just very frequently run into people who say, oh,
they recognize you?
Or not. They may or may not have read something I did, but they'll definitely want to ask me about our very famous writers for the magazine, or, you know, they'll be very interested in, you know, talking about our latest cover story and things like that.
Do you do much traveling for the magazine, or are you mostly now in D.C.?
What I do is mostly in D.C. If we have a video or something that needs to be done elsewhere, I usually hire someone. I just had a writer fly out to Detroit to talk to Elmore Leonard, you know, the fiction writer. So, you know, I'll organize that sort of thing, but I won't usually be the one to go myself, which is just as well at the moment.
Do you interact with new writers much?
Yeah, mostly, actually, I would say.
So those are the people that you're editing?
Yeah.
If there's somebody listening, excuse me, that wants to submit something to the Atlantic, mm-hmm, what do they do?
So you can send me an email. My email address is jrothenberg, that's jrothenberg at theatlantic.com. And I would just, the advice I would give is just to look at the website and get familiar with, I mentioned the different sections, you know, politics, business, entertainment, you know, just get a sense of where this might fit in. And, you know, and also, you know, we're not a news publication in the sense that it's not a place to, you know, breaking news. It's more to sort of tell
sort
people,
of thoughtful,
yeah, like what to think about the news, or what, just sort
reflecting.
Of reflecting, yeah, reflecting and finding just something. It could be some little story. This is just kind of a funny example that popped into mind, but we had a great piece about a place in New Hampshire called Jew Pond. It was actually called Jew Pond on the map, and there's a sort of a vote whether to change the name, and it was just a ridiculous little local story, but it spoke to this bigger issue about place names across the U.S. that have kind of racist and, you know, implications, and whether, so that's kind of a good example of a very specific story that actually has some kind of, it touches into, you know, some core.
So
national.
Would a freelancer have, like, queried you on that? Is that, like,
yeah,
how, and do you have a word length limit you want to tell people about? Or?
Well, the best way to do is to start with a pitch, just to say, sort of tell me a little bit about what the story is, and if it's not right for the section I edit, I'll pass it to a colleague, and then we can give you more specifics. You know, I mean, usually it's, I would say, like around 1,200 words, but that's very rough. It could be give or take a lot.
Do most of the, let's say, freelance workers, writers you work with, have a journalistic background, or do you get some people that really, you know, don't have an education in writing, they're just kind of interested in things?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'll tell you honestly, you don't have to have that much of a background, but I also tell you honestly, we don't pay very much. I mean, that's the
trade-off. There's the honor of being in an esteemed publication.
Right. I mean, most of what we publish, either it's by very well-known writers who just have something urgent they want to say right now that can't wait, you know, till print publication, you know, so then, well, that's why they write for us, or they, you know, they make enough money, you know, say maybe they write, like, you know, 10,000 word articles for us, and then they want to write, you know, a 1,000 word thing quickly. So we have that kind of piece. Then we have you know, people who just really want their name to, you know, be in the Atlantic, and they want to use it as a clip. So, I mean, there's quite a range. But if you want that one article to pay your rent that month, unless, actually, in Fairfield, the rent's kind of cheap. You could probably write a couple articles for us to pay your rent.
That's interesting. Do you ever go out and meet writers at conferences or at schools?
The Atlantic, not really, because we just have so many pitches coming to us all the time anyway that, we don't.
So you don't need to do that.
No, but although I do sometimes send emails, and we're Berkeley, where I went to grad school. I remember when I was there, I was desperate. You know, we were writing all the time anyway as a student, and you're desperate to get it published. So I'll send emails to the professor saying, hey guys, have any great stories come up in your class? Send them my way.
You know. Oh, cool. Do you have connections with some of the people who were your classmates?
Yeah, a few of them. Yeah, actually quite a few. One of them just wrote a book. My classmate Robin Schulman just wrote a great book about the history of food in New York. So I'm on Facebook, and I connect with a lot of them that way.
Is there anything else that you want, any other advice for writers?
Yeah, I think, well, that last question you asked about pitching, I think that's a really...
Oh, yeah, what makes a good pitch?
Yeah,
let's talk about that. Because I'm sure that's very specific, what you want to see.
Definitely. I mean, I think being really... Yeah, first of all, being really aware of the publication. We get a lot of junk mail just that
haven't read it.
Yeah, they haven't read The Atlantic. Just, I think your readers would love to learn news you can use about how to get a cool tattoo. And it's like, okay, that's not something we would publish.
Wait, I noticed that it didn't seem like I was excluded from anything when I was just visiting The Atlantic site.
So we don't have a paywall, you mean?
Yeah. Can people just go and read the whole publication right there?
For now, yes. Stick around.
Really a deal.
Yeah, it's ideal right now. Well, I mean, this is part of the whole... I mean, we've had phases where everything was behind a paywall. We've had phases where nothing was. I think...
we better enjoy this while it lasts.
Yeah, I think there's probably going to be... If you go to the New York Times, for example, you can read a certain number. They have, kind of different algorithms. You can read a certain number of pieces before you have to pay.
Per month. It seemed like per month. I've had that happen where I've exceeded my limit.
Right, so I think that's probably the future.
And the Atlantic website is...
That's www.theatlantic.com.
So anybody who's interested in writing for you, first thing is go and read as much as they can... Mm-hmm. on the website, which is now free right now.
Yeah. So read this.
And then when they start to write their pitch, what should they do?
I think, we like to have some kind of twist. I mean, if it's the same story that everyone else is already reporting, we're probably not going to be interested. But if there's, you hear this term in journalism, a second day lead, it's sort of like after everyone's already read the main story, what questions are they going to be asking, or what are they going to be thinking about, or what are they going to, want to know that no one else has talked about yet? So that's one kind of good story. If there's something in the news that, there's a next day lead. I mean, for me, my favorite kinds of stories actually are narrative stories. So in other words, stories that tell a story about a person or a place or a situation, but they tap into something larger. Like a couple stories I mentioned about the neighborhood where everyone's flying rainbow flags to support gay marriage. That's a really local, really specific story.
So it's like the point value.
Yeah, exactly.
And then there's a larger, cultural issue at
exactly.
stake.
Exactly. Or like a story about a certain group of teenagers who are kids of illegal immigrants and what they're trying to do in Connecticut to try to help, get so they can go to college without getting deported. But it taps into that larger story. But I really like reading about real people in real places. I think when possible we favor that over just opinion pieces, because we get so many people on the internet just wanting to mouth off. And
you probably prefer publishing opinion pieces by someone who's sort of established and well known.
We have plenty of our own people doing that. And yeah, exactly.
Do you have time anymore to read books?
Yeah, I've been trying to make. I mean, there's between.
You're probably reading a lot of baby books.
baby books and really good books about babies. There's this writer, Allison Gopnik. Her brother writes for The New Yorker, but she's a beautiful writer, and she's a child psychologist in Berkeley. And she has these great books about the philosophical baby, where she just talks about what really goes on in their minds. And she has this great ending in one of her books about, and I'm feeling this a lot now, when you take a toddler to go get a carton of milk at the store, it's like going to get milk with William Blake, because everything is completely vivid. The dog, it's not just some dog. It's like the dog. The sky is blue. It's blue. Like my kid will be walking the park just yelling, green, green, and pointing to the leaves.
Yeah, it's a really interesting time of life. I remember that, where you walk on the sidewalk and there might be a turtle.
Yeah.
Or even just a pebble. I mean, anything, a
like
dandelion.
An ant. He's screaming, ant. Everything's so vivid.
It's a complete appreciation of everything around you.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've about come to the end of our time, so I want to thank you for being here. I'll remind listeners, this is Writer's Voices you've been listening to. I'm Cheryl Fusco Johnson. Our guest today was Jenny Rothenberg. It's Rothenberg Gritz, a person who's from Fairfield, and we're really pleased that she's done so well out in the world and that she's come back and spent some time sharing her expertise with us. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Cheryl. This was so much fun.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.